Welcome back to I2, where we open your eyes with new perspectives. Mark Ryle taught economics and mathematics at Royal St. George's College in Toronto and Hillfield Strathalan College in Hamilton for a combined 24 years. He recently published a science fiction novel, Age Decoded. Whilst having written the first draft about 10 years ago, the world of genetic engineering has changed dramatically, particularly in the past few years, where CRISPR technology won a Nobel Prize. The book has a strong focus on this technology and the physical and psychological ways it will impact human life as we know it.
Thank you for being here today, Mark. It's great to have you on the I2 show.
Thank you, Julian. Thank you very much.
I wanted to start a little bit about talking about your background. So your childhood and your life at school, where did you grow up?
I grew up in a place called Windsor, Ontario, which is sort of west of Toronto, smaller town. And I lived there till I was about 8 years old. And then I moved to, because my dad got transferred on his job, I moved to a lot of different places in Canada. I've always lived in Canada though. And I ended up in Toronto in high school. And then after that, I went to Waterloo for University of Waterloo and University of Toronto. So I've lived in about, I guess, 7 or 8 different places in Canada itself.
What was your college experience like getting your bachelor and then ultimately your PhD?
College was pretty, it wasn't a straight line path. It was sort of sideways, upwards. So I did end up getting a PhD, but that wasn't until I was in my 30s. I did an MBA in my late 20s. God knows why. I just wanted to learn about business because I knew nothing about business. So that was a fast and furious 2 years of learning about business. It was neat, but I did not end up going into business. And then my bachelor's was science, although I started in engineering. So I switched out of engineering, went into more kinesiology, science, biomechanics, which I really loved. That was a good switch for me.
Yeah, because you did a lot of triathlons and were involved in sports. So was that sort of part of the motivation to do?
For sure, yeah. So when I was in engineering, I was a very good student. I'm very strong in math and science. Those are my main areas, but my interests really weren't in that area. I was more interested in humans and physiology and biomechanics. And I was running at the time, doing some competitive marathon running. So I remember speaking to my advisor in engineering saying, I'm thinking of dropping out and switching out. And he said, well, why? You're doing really well. And I said, well, I can't take these other courses in engineering. It's too constrained, the curriculum. So, and that sort of made sense. And he understood that. So he didn't try to stop me, but it was a good move for me and sort of went with my gut feel. It's a tough move though, because, my parents and others, friends always thought I was a math science guy and that's where I'd end up always. So
surprise them all.
Yeah.
So with all of that, did you have these sort of motivations when you were in like high school, or even did you develop those sort of that inclination towards business in towards your later years in high school and then ultimately genetics and those sort of fields?
So the genetics stuff, which relates to my novel, that didn't come until much later when I was sort of had gotten back into running. And actually it's my daughter, I could blame it on my daughter, a very positive blame here. She, when she was, I believe, 8 years old, she didn't know I had run when I was younger. So she just started running one day and she said, I'm heading around the block, and off she went. And I'm thinking, well, you're only 8 years old. I better go with you, right? Just make sure you don't get lost or something. So I found an old pair of sneakers and went with her, and her very first steps were my first step back into little middle age running, and not triathloning yet. I didn't even start that till later, but middle age. And I followed her, and it was very easy for me because she was only 8 years old. So she's huffing and puffing and looking up at me, and it's pretty easy for me. But within about, I'd say, 4 years, when she was 12, she was super fast. And by this time, I'm in my high 40s, almost 50 years old. And I had problems keeping up with her. She was very motivated, and she didn't train it too much because you got to be careful with young kids, but she trained enough to get fast, and she's a naturally gifted runner. So that got me back into it. And then I started looking into age group competition and all this, because now I'm old enough that I'm not competing against the young professionals. So, which is fair, right? So everything's age group. I was, when I started triathloning, I was in the, first of all, in the 50 to 55 year old age group. And that group, I noticed that a lot of people were really sensitive about age. Like if you're 55, the 55 year olds would look at the 50 year olds and say, oh, you're a lot younger than I am. And you know, you got a big advantage at 5 years. And I'm like, whoa, are you that highly fine tuned that you can tell 5 years? And they could actually tell 1 year at a time. You get a little bit slower. You're approaching death, right? And your body is slowing down a bit. Your maximum oxygen uptake goes down a little bit, your aerobic capacity. So I thought, well, that's really interesting. I'll read about this. And I started reading about aging and genetics, what had a lot to do with it, because it's a genetic thing, right? And I discovered that there's a lot of amazing scientific research going on in the world right now on the genetic front to stop and maybe even reverse aging. So that's how I started into the novel and the interest in this topic.
Okay, wow. So you weren't really paying attention to like the news and the media during the time when you were in college or like as an adult, like a younger adult, all of the discoveries that were happening back then?
No, and although it's really ramped up in the last, say, 10 or 15 years, this idea of genetic engineering, CRISPR technology, if you want to talk about that, we can. And the awarding of the Nobel Prize to the two fantastic female researchers, Jennifer Doudna from the United States and Emmanuel Charpentier from Europe. Those two got the Nobel in 2020 for their really intense work on not perfecting, but really improving the CRISPR genetic engineering technique.
Yeah, I'd definitely love to talk a bit more about CRISPR. It's a field that I'm particularly interested in.
Okay.
But before we get into your book and the way that you got around to writing that, I want to talk a little bit about your early professional life. So you started off as a lecturer for economics, which is obviously quite different to obviously the things that you're interested in now. What was your first ever lecture like?
Yeah, so my first, I started teaching at university, teaching biomechanics in the at University of Waterloo. Now, I didn't have my PhD then, but I was teaching, doing lecturing there and doing all the labs too, which is pretty fascinating stuff. And then I did some also at physiology. I taught some physiology at Simon Fraser University, but that was sort of a brief stint. Most of my teaching had after that came at the high school level in grade 11, 12, and 13, which I really loved. And I was teaching economics and mathematics. Those were my two subjects. And coaching, of course. I bet you can guess what I coached. if you want to guess? Take a guess.
All the athletics and running.
The running stuff, yes. Yeah. So the cross-country running and also track and field, yes.
Wow. It was a very different career path.
Yeah, I mean, and even sitting here today on your podcast, your iTunes podcast, I would never have imagined being on a podcast talking about a fiction book that I would have written, because I've never studied English. And if I had ever written a book, I would have thought it would be a nonfiction. I am actually working on a nonfiction right now on running and training, but that was swept aside by this fiction idea of genetic engineering somehow.
Just put on the back burner. I think science fiction is a bit more fun to deal with.
Yeah, it's been fun. Yeah.
You also worked at two of the like well-known international companies, EY and KPMG. What was that experience like?
That was a brief foray of mine. What happened when I did my PhD, it was in education and it was a focus on finance. I was looking at all the taxpayer dollars spent on public schools in Ontario and how they might save money by sort of sharing resources between different school boards. For example, if you had like two big boards right next to each other. They could share curriculum, or they could share specialized teachers, stuff like that, and just ways of saving money without, you know, without going crazy or losing their autonomy. And so that thesis at the time in the 1990s was a very hot topic. And so I, as soon as I got my PhD, there were a couple of these consulting firms, Ernst & Young and KPMG, were interested in having me sort of help them with their education public sector consulting files. And that was fun, but it wasn't really my true self. And that's more the corporate, it's still a business and it's more the corporate life. And my attention very quickly turned off from that into teaching again. Like after a few years of that, I just had this hankering to get back into teaching, which I did.
Didn't buy into the corporate life?
No, it was fun and it was really interesting work. Like anybody out there listening, if you're interested in consulting, it's great. It's a great area. The projects are amazing. You learn so much. And just say, take an area like healthcare right now. They really need people to look at healthcare, different ways of doing it, not just saving money or making it more efficient, but really more innovative ways. It's a very complex system, right? Healthcare, and I assume in Australia where you are, it's just like Canada. It's just a mixed bag of so many different things. So yeah. If I was young right now and I was interested in consulting, I would look at healthcare. And, like, for example, I have a friend who had, I think, a history degree, but he learned about blood, what they do with blood, how they supply it, where they get it, different types of blood, and how they send it to hospitals and what it's used for. And he became sort of a blood expert, believe it or not. And he had a whole career in consulting the healthcare system on the blood specialty. And so you never know where you're going to end up, right? And but there's lots of room for young minds in that field and to move into that area.
I think that's some great advice, and particularly as someone in science, I know that there's, when you're at university, there's, you know, you're not really imagining a lot of the career paths that you can take. And I've never even really thought about or heard about health consulting in that sort of a professional corporate sense. So that's really interesting take.
You could start working for a large corporation if you get, are you in a science program right now, science?
Yes, yeah, Bachelor of Science.
Good, that's great. And you could even, I dare say it, you could even start your own company if you had a little bit of specialty in or interest in one area with yourself or a few people. But those are the sort of options you have, and they're both very exciting.
Yeah, so starting a company would definitely be an amazing thing to try and tackle. Speaking of things that you have to tackle, you started writing your book, now moving the book Age Decoded. You yes. started writing this one about 10 years ago. What was the process and the complications of writing a book over that 10 years?
So I did that while I was teaching full time. So crafting the book took me about a year on the side. And then I tried to publish it. Now I didn't, like, I'm an unpublished author with no experience. So I found it very difficult to get any of the big publishers, like the New York publishers or Toronto ones, to even read a page. Like, it was that difficult. You could send out letters and all that. And I think there was one publisher who was interested in the States, and then they went bankrupt a couple of weeks, months later. So unfortunately, that was my own. Anyway,
thank goodness you didn't publish with them.
At least I didn't cause their bankruptcy, but it was tough. It was very tough. I'm no experience writing, and also science fiction is an extremely competitive category. So there's lots of writers out there. So I sort of understood it, and I didn't take it too hard. I put it on the back burner. And then when I retired from teaching 2 years ago, I went right back to the novel. Had a great opportunity with COVID and all that, so sitting at home, to upgrade all the science. A lot had changed. And to actually improve the novel, I cut out a few chapters, added several new chapters. I got editors involved to look at it and got great feedback. I didn't listen to everything, but I listened to most of their feedback. And so I think I was able to improve the novel, upgrade the science. And then as I mentioned to you, CRISPR and genetic engineering is way more top of mind It's moving at a frenetic pace right now. So it was probably, it's probably serendipity that actually it wasn't published 10 years ago that I got it out this year. And also self-publishing. I never went back to any publishers this year. I just said, you know what, I'm going to just self-publish this. It's so much easier to do right now. And so that's what I did. And it's been a nice ride. I've had it out for about 3 months.
Yeah, it's, I think it was a great, it's a very accessible way to understand CRISPR. And as you said, CRISPR has really taken off in the past couple of years since the researchers received that Nobel Prize. I personally didn't know about it until that prize. And I know it's been around for 15, 20 years prior. So I think that is something that writing a book over such a period of time about such a fast evolving topic is beneficial, kind of works in your favor.
Yeah. So there's the another thing I'd say to your listeners is it's good to fail. I failed miserably 10 years ago, right? And I didn't let it kill me. Like I think Winston Churchill said that success is not final and failure is not fatal. And I like that because I was on the failure side of it. It's not fatal. It's just, and now it's turned in my favor. In fact, it was probably lucky that I failed then and now I'm doing it now. So it's funny how things do work out sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. So what made you want to have that background string of science fiction to talk about such a complex and topical issue such as genetic technology?
Okay, so I'm not a genomicist or a genetic expert, so I had to learn all this sort of on the side. And I mean, I have a science degree, right? But it was from the 1980s. How much is that? But so, you know, it would be the only way I could approach this would be through science fiction, which is great because it's very creative and I enjoyed it. But I do say to people that my novel starts 50 years into the future and goes about 250 years into the future. And I try to write it like this is what I think could happen. It's not like aliens and another planet fantasy and all. No, it's this is really what I think is the world's going to be like or could be like. So if you asked even experts in this field, like even Jennifer Doudna and her coworkers and others to try to project out a couple centuries, it's going to be science fiction anyway, right? And even if they're an expert, it's, you know, okay, well, you know, what's not just genetic engineering, what's the world going to be like? So I try to incorporate all of those things, technology, information technologies, supercomputers, neurointegration of smartphones inside your head, and just the environment. Like, what would New York be like? What would New Orleans be like? Those are the two main settings in my novel. I really try to predict. And then, of course, the genetic engineering aspects. And so when we can talk about that, that's probably the most interesting, that part of the novel.
Yeah, definitely. So I managed to be able to flick through a few pages and I'm quite interested in reading the rest of it. But the way that you address the nuances and the details of the life at those times, those years that you've chosen, 2253, is really interesting, particularly writing in science fiction at a time where we don't know how fast all of this is going to evolve, and centering it around the main character who is an older gentleman. And he has, you know, because often when we think about CRISPR, we think about the younger generations, people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, that want to preserve their life and focus on youth.
Yes.
So what made you choose that particular anchor
for
that sort of technology?
There are actually three anchors. Now, it depends on how far into the novel you've read. The older gentleman, his name is Jesus, even though he's a Buddhist. He's a very thoughtful, philosophical, former scientist who's near the end of his life. But he's locked into this, what's called age decoding, so he doesn't get any older. So he's almost 80 years old, but he's not getting a day older. But he's not getting any younger yet either, so... That's Jesus. I think you may be referring to him. His daughter is the heroine of the novel, and that's Dr. Frieda. Dr. Frieda invents this using CRISPR, this age decoding that stops aging. And the government really wants to implement it because it's going to make them super popular. So it's offered for free. It's actually fairly simple. You just go in for a 20-minute procedure, almost like you would for a vaccine. They stop your aging in its tracks, and that's in 2053. So that's in about 30 years. Now, I don't know if in reality it's going to be in 30 years, but I suspect that there's a lot of reading. We can talk about the research. There are a lot of very bright minds working on this right now, and some people are predicting around that time period. It could be another 50 years beyond that. I don't know, but many good researchers see aging as a disease that must be eradicated, and they are working feverishly to do so. Anyway, so that's the heroine is Dr. Frieda, because she has some ethical and moral reservations about the whole thing, even though she's the bright mind that invents it. So she's speaking out sort of against it, or she's very hesitant about it. So they try to muzzle her by actually kidnapping her and bringing her underground. They don't want to lose her because she's got such a wonderful mind, but they want to just muzzle her. So they fake her suicide. So everybody thinks she's killed herself. She hasn't. They've taken her underground, and she, in the novel, is underground captive for 200 years. And it's just a horrible thing, because her father, this Jesus guy, thinks she's killed herself. Her husband, he's not a main character, but he also thinks she's taking her own life. And then she has a daughter, Zainana, who is about your age, and Zainana is just beside herself because she's lost the mother she loved so much. And in the new society where everybody's living forever, you can't really have children, so she's not gonna have a child. She has no mother. She thinks she doesn't have a mother. And her father, when her mother supposedly killed herself, he left. He had a nervous breakdown and sort of took off. So there's a lot of that intergenerational stuff in there in the novel, which is one of the main effects, I think, will be of this view. I mean, there's a dystopian element to this, and that's one of your dystopian elements, is you lose all that beautiful interlove between the generations, grandmother, mother, father, all that stuff, right?
I think that's a really great way to address those particular issues around these genetic engineering ideas that are supposed to prevent aging. About like having children and the sort of values that we hold today that wouldn't be present in such a society. So could you briefly explain in this sort of that easy to understand way what CRISPR technology is?
Yeah, so CRISPR was originally based on some sort of a bacteria virus that the bacteria used to fight off offenders. And so I think Dr. Mojica came up with the term, and I'm not going to tell people what it stands for. It's just polysyllabic, but it's CRISPR. But they came up with the term about, like you mentioned, about 15 years ago. And it's, so they use this bacteria-based particle or set of molecules to, in combination with other messengers like nanobodies and things, to move into the DNA of anything living. So you can go into the DNA of anything living, and you can alter that DNA. You can edit it, you can cut things out, you can block things. It's a little like editing a Word document. If you think of a good analogy is Walter Isaacson wrote the book Codebreaker, which is a best-selling book right now, on Jennifer Doudna and the process of CRISPR discovery. And that's a nonfiction, but he had a good way of explaining it. There's the book is the entire genome of a person or a living thing. And then the pages are the genes that can, the separate pages. And then with all across those pages is the DNA, which is the words. And the DNA is, as I learned more about it, it's pretty immense. There's probably about 25 to 30,000 genes for humans. So pages in the book. And then there's, you can go even more detailed. The words have letters in them, and the letters are almost like the nucleotides that make up the base pairs. So the nucleotides, there's something like 3 billion of them in humans. So, and there's four different combinations for each nucleotide. So if you want to do the math, it's in my book. It's 4 to the exponent 3 billion possible permutations of to make up a human being, the genetic code. So that's a massive number. I don't even know how big it is, but it's way off the charts. But that's why everybody's unique. Even the identical twins are unique. They're not completely identical, but they're pretty close. But yeah, so how did I start? Yeah, that's the analogy. And so of what CRISPR is and what it's doing is it's going in there and altering. Often you can just alter like two nucleotides, like two words, two letters in a word. You can get that specific. But the problem is it's not perfect. So you might, you know how when you edit a document, sometimes you make a little mistake, you missed a period or something like that, or you add something unintentionally. That can happen with CRISPR. So the challenge is to make it safer and more fine-tuned. And there's huge applications. I'd love to talk about some of those, like some positive things coming down the road with this type of editing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that particularly for children that are born with different genetic diseases, that's one of the main focuses of these sort of technologies. How would you say it compares to a lot of the gene editing technologies that is used in agriculture, for example?
Yeah, it's similar. I mean, in the past, we've bred livestock and we've bred crops, right? Like, for example, corn and things like that. But now you're talking about genetically modifying, right? So that's a similar process. And you have to be careful, right? You got to make sure you know what the effects are. And so it's quite comparable. And this genetic engineering will be used for other species. Right now, they've just, for example, in the Florida Keys, they've released a batch of mosquitoes that have been genetically modified to drive out the mosquitoes that are carrying disease like dengue and yellow fever. And so that's a genetic modification of another species, still supposed to help humans. And maybe another example is down near you, the coral reef. Is it not being affected by global warming and warmer water?
Yes, now a lot of the coral has been dying because the waters are getting warmer and there's a lot more pollution. But okay. Actually, because of COVID, a large part of that has been starting to restore, and there are a lot of conservation projects. But yeah, definitely that's an issue for us.
So I was reading there's the potential to genetically modify coral to make it more resistant to warm water, which, so don't be surprised if they have a coral genetic drive, similar to what they did with the mosquitoes to drive out the weaker coral and bring in stronger coral.
Wow, that's that's definitely an out of the box application for it. A lot of these efforts to make certain eradicate certain harmful species and to balance out certain ecosystems has resulted in quite detrimental effects. And particularly in Australia, we've had issues with cane toads and rabbits that were, you know, cane toads were brought in to kill rabbits, but they actually did very little for that and caused so much more harm to the flora and fauna. How do you think that this is would come up in genetic engineering such as CRISPR?
A huge issue. I would call that unintended side effects, right? Even in economics, that's always an issue. So anytime humans embark on a new solution to something, there's always unintended side effects. Even, you know, if you take a vaccine, there can be unintended side effects. So we have to be very careful. There's a book written up here in Canada by a professor, if I could put a plug in for her, Francois Berlis. She just released a book a few months ago with Harvard University, and it's called The Altered Inheritance. And she talks about She's a genomicist, so she's a genetic engineer specialist. She talks about the moral and ethical issues, and she talks a lot about the unintended side effects and the worries about that. And she doesn't hold any punches. It's an excellent book for those who are really interested in this topic called, as I said, it's called Altered Inheritance by Francois Baylis.
Yeah, that's so true. I think the biggest issue with anything related to genetics and human altering is the ethical issues, because when you're dealing with plants and animals, these days there's more so issues with animals, but plants, definitely there's no question if something goes wrong, doesn't really have too much of an effect when it's in a lab setting. But humans, that's very, very different. I don't know if you mentioned it. I've heard some of your other podcasts where you have talked a little bit about the big issue with the Chinese professor who genetically edited twins, actually against all of the legal and restrictive constraints. So yeah, could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So that scientist, He Zhengku, and I probably butchered the pronunciation there, but He Zhengku he crossed sort of a moral line in the sand by genetically modifying the embryos of at least two embryos, who are now children. So, that's fairly serious, because if I just genetically modify an adult and they don't reproduce and pass that on, then at least it's within that individual. It's not going to get into the gene pool and move through these species, right? With future generations. But what he did will go into the gene pool. And he was trying to protect these children from HIV. So, and he had a pretty good method, but you're not really supposed to do that. That's frowned upon. That's called heritable gene editing. It's inheritable what you're doing. If you edit sperm and egg, or even embryos, that's going to be embedded in the complete DNA code of that person and will be passed on if they reproduce. That's pretty serious. That scientist was imprisoned once the Chinese authorities found out, and the scientific community was up in arms over it too. So
yeah, absolutely. That goes against so many restraints that are put in place to protect individuals, and particularly really vulnerable individuals as children. So I think, yeah, that definitely was a really big issue. And these sort of issues are what everybody talks about. The designer babies, that's one of the big topics that people know about when it comes to gene editing. So there's these two aspects. There's the genetics, the health, eradicating diseases like HIV, Down syndrome, and then there's also the sort of vanity of it. Yes. Could you touch a little bit on those topics? The sort of, how does that line come in? Because one of the things that I read as well was, when you do change things that are related to these diseases, the effects on the physical appearance and the actual physical phenotype are quite unpredictable.
Yeah, Julia, that's a good way of differentiating. You talk about, like, you know, disease, and then what did you say? It was like more like ego.
The vein.
Vein. Yeah. So that's actually not a bad way of differentiating as a starting point, because most people wouldn't have too much. There would be some. There's always opposition to anything, right? But most people would probably support using genetic engineering to, say, eradicate something like cystic fibrosis or Huntington's. And those are two very strong candidates from what I've read, because their genetic, the genetic issue there is very, very tiny. Like, I think for cystic fibrosis, it's literally two of those nucleotides being flipped. The C and the G instead of G and C, like literally that's it. So they can, those sort of things are called, are treatment, right? Treatment. They're not for vanity reasons. I don't know if you've known any families with cystic fibrosis members or Huntington's. I've known families with both, not one family with both, but two families one with Huntington's and one with cystic fibrosis. And they're horrible afflictions that are genetically passed on. And so one way is to treat that through genetic engineering. Also, you can do genetic screening, like PGD, which is pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, where you don't really genetically modify anything, but what you do is you have the couple that are thinking of having a baby who think they might have this genetic line in their family, you have them produce several embryos, and then you examine, you do the diagnosis of the embryos and make sure that, and you eliminate the embryos that have the disease and you keep the ones that don't. Now, people who are anti-abortion, you can see they would have a small issue with that, right? But generally, most people would probably support that too. So anyway, that's all treatment and probably not too too messy ethically compared to this vanity thing, which is a whole other, maybe designer babies. You know, I want a baby with blue eyes or more intelligent than as intelligent as could be, or creative, or it could be anything. You could be genetically modifying or selecting for those sort of features. And I think that's where we start wondering. And it could even go into athletics where, I want to be strong. I want the strongest kid, the fastest runner. And we're going to do whatever we can genetically to produce that sort of offspring.
That's obviously you having been involved so heavily in running and athletics. That is such a concern for the sports industry, because obviously there's already chemical doping and these different chemical changes. So what do you know of any of the restrictions that are in place or going or being talked about putting in place for genetic modification?
Yeah, I actually checked the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, to see, because they've been dealing with steroids, right? They're pretty good at it, although they can't stop it, but they try to deal with it as best they can. So they're sort of the world authority on this, and they have a policy now for genetic engineering. They're ready. They're bracing themselves. I think they wrote it a few years ago. I was surprised. I think they wrote it like 2016, 2017. They're ready.
Oh, my.
In favor of genetic engineering for athletic performance. But I think it's going to be like steroids. People are so motivated to win and to be the best and the top and all the endorsements and like financial and all the ego and all that. So people are very competitive. They will do what it takes. So I would not be surprised to see national programs trying to push this stuff secretly even.
Yeah, I think one of the beauties of sport is watching just like, you know, people who you can relate to who have trained so hard and they've been so motivated and they're all of a sudden achieving these goals. Now with the Olympics, that's such a great thing to see. Some of our Australian athletes have achieved amazing feats, broken records. Do you think that will change if genetic engineering was involved? Do you think that would change people's affiliations and affinities to sport?
So, but yeah, you Aussies did really well in the Olympics. Congratulations. We did okay. So you guys are, and New Zealand. I was really impressed by New Zealand. It does change. It sort of stigmatizes it a bit. Like my daughter's a long distance runner, right? And she, you know, when someone wins the big, her first curiosity is like, could this person have been doping or whatever? And it's sad, but in a lot of sports, that is still an issue. And so if genetic engineering is thrown into mix as a potential alteration or you know, one leg up from the competitor, then you also wonder, it's going to make people, it does stigmatize things, no doubt about that. But I'm going to predict that a lot of world records are going to fall from genetic engineering. Maybe it might take a while, but I think there's already people, individuals experimenting with this, from what I've heard. I won't give any sources on that one, but it's not a conspiracy theory. I think there's people actually taking things that they think are going to give them a genetic boost.
I wouldn't be surprised. I think there's sort of two areas here. There's the ideas that we were talking about before with therapeutic genetic engineering, and then the sort of more vain. You can sort of relate that to how medicine has grown over the past couple of decades, where we had initially emergency medicine, treatment medicine, but we also have life improvement medicine, how to, nutritionists and psychologists about taking your life as it is. You're not particularly sick, but you're trying to improve it beyond what it is. So in terms of genetics, looking at it like that, do you think that it's more of an issue, the ethics that come along with, say, the more vain choices that people would have with these genetic engineering techniques? Do you think that it's more of an issue with the timeline? Because if it evolved the same way as medicine, you know, people could be more accepting of something like that, of life improvement genetic engineering.
Yeah. It's well, there's a lot of trade-offs and there's competing factors. So if I could go back to just money spent, a lot of these procedures will be somewhat expensive, and we will support some of them, like publicly funded. You have corporations involved, governments and government scientific foundations, and scientists, so universities and whatnot. So you have a lot of players involved, and they will get support on some fronts. But once you get into the vanity enhancement type stuff, that's where it's going to be. I think it's going to be splintered. So you're going to have people, like individuals with the funds or the money, will be able to purchase those. Let's say you wanted to genetically modify yourself or your son or daughter to make them more intelligent. Or let's say you had an older mother or father who's suffering from Alzheimer's. And if you have the wherewithal, I think you will, those people with wealth. So there's an equity issue here. There's no doubt there's going to be an equity issue. We're not going to publicly support all of these things. There's no way. And those vanity things are going to be the things that will have the inequities, I think. And that sort of makes sense, right? Whereas we
A lot the same with medicine, how you see in like plastic surgery and those sort of issues.
Exactly. Yeah. So whereas other things are in the middle, like artificial hips, right? Well, we generally support that. Like my wife has had two hip surgeries in Ontario and Canada here, we have a publicly funded healthcare system, and that they cover her artificial hip surgery, and most people support that, you know.
I think, yeah, when you get into issues of medical treatments that have a physical effect, might be a positive one, might be a negative one, I think that's where it becomes a little bit shadier and hard to distinguish those lines. Something that you touched on a little bit just before when we were talking about sport is the issues of people doing things under the radar and outside of the eye of the media. It comes up a little bit in your book as well. And I think a lot of science fiction touches on those things that aren't seen by the media. Do you think that it could be possible these sort of testings and these sort of modifications are already happening widespread, but the media just don't know about it, the public don't know about it, and it's all underground in a sense?
I do think so. And a little bit like steroids, again, there's an analogy there. Or even say, nuclear technology, look how that has been handled. Sometimes it's cloak and dagger, which nations are developing it, which ones are you worried about, how is it controlled internationally. There's going to, genetic engineering is a whole other area that is going to demand a very smart people, young people like yourself, who take an interest in it and want to have an input, because the whole world needs to know about this and to harness it in a positive way, because there can be some negative implications too. There's no doubt about it. In my book, just to touch upon one of the negatives, I have a psychological effect that's used. So genetic engineering can be used for any trait, so anything that can affect your personality, psychology. And in my book, people do not know, but when they go in to get age decoded and stop their aging, there's another little bit of change that goes on that they're unaware of, and it's a psychological manipulation, and it plays a pretty big part. I put that in there because that's the double-edged sword. I wanted, you know, you have to have a bit of dystopia anyway, and you have to have a scandal, right? And that is the scandal, and it's very important for people to know that, like nuclear technology, like information technology, there's always humans are capable of doing, unscrupulous things or evil things too. And that has to be watched carefully.
I really like that you have included that as a topic in your book, because it is very topical, particularly at the moment. And it is something that we often don't think about, because we see ourselves as these autonomous, individual, unique personalities. And that can be changed really quickly. And that's even like with physical injury, we've seen different brain injuries. That's such a difficult thing to talk about. So without getting into the deep philosophical side of it, just touching on that brief psychological difference, I want to talk a little bit about the obsession with you. I think that how much people are invested in returning back to their age, that does sort of add to their personality as they get older. With this sort of world that you've created in your book, where people can get age decoded, do you think that, say, this were the path that our future were to take, do you think that that sort of issue of consenting to get your age decoded and then changing your minds because of that technology that's influenced your brain, do you think that that's something that would be an issue?
Yeah, so in my book, the two are sort of separate. So the age decoder is a physical thing. Aging is a disease. We're going to eradicate that, and they do so. The psychological one is the what's called, I'll put it in quotations, the propensity to dissent, or propensity for really critical thinking, which the government puts in to entrench their power. And I know it sounds a little bit, okay, you know, why would you do that? But and it could happen through a corporation. It doesn't have to be the government. I'm not necessarily anti-government person, but any large institution with a lot of power could be any entity, large entity that does that. But I put that in there to give people pause and to again, shine the light on the non-physical, that's not a physical thing, but still a genetic thing, side of it, and the negative side of it. And luckily the novel isn't so dystopian that it ends up, you know, all bad. There's some good stuff that happens. I don't want to give away too much, but
gotta read the book.
It definitely, but even just the aging thing, even though it looked like it was the positive, but it's not so positive. It's not a bowl of cherries. It's one of my characters, Jesus, I mentioned, he quotes, he's really into interbeing and the interconnectedness of everything, like sort of like you mentioned how, change to a species introduced to an area will affect other things. It's all that interconnectedness, that Buddhist concept of interconnectedness, and they call it interbeing. He's really into that. And even he wonders in the end, he's got I'm going to just paraphrase, but I can't remember the exact word, but he basically says that there's a quote by Anonymous, which says that the person who steals your time, the biggest thief is the person who steals your time. And he says, you know what? I think it's wrong. I think it's the opposite. The biggest thief is the person who gives you too much time in your life because they steal your humanity. And I just love that, the way he says that, they steal your humanity. Being immortal, is that really human in the end? What will that do to people's psychology, knowing they can live endless centuries? And, like I've said on a couple other podcasts, I probably would not have written this book if I knew I would live forever. I wouldn't have had the, the rush to write it. I don't think.
Yeah, that motivation. Awesome. I think that the way that you tackle these issues is really quite clever, because everything is interconnected and it can be very overwhelming to think of it that way, because everything leads to something else and you're thinking about genetics, you're thinking about personality, ethics, psychology. So it does turn into a bit of like a whirlwind rabbit hole, and separating it is often the best way to go about understanding it. That yes. Quote about humanity, I think that that's quite important. It's definitely something that comes up a lot in these sort of science fiction style novels, that idea of what actually makes us human. And there are a lot of theories on it. I've read quite a lot in philosophy. So it is quite important to think about our life and our value as beyond just this mechanical, physical, aging being. Yes. I read a quote once that said, aging has to be earned. You have to actually live through your life to earn your age. And I think that that's a really topical issue with genetic decoding. Do you think that in terms of evolution, that's one of the really important issues? We're actually stepping in and essentially stopping the evolution of our species.
Yes.
Do you think that when it comes to the conflict of the personality, preserving that specific person,
yes,
or the evolution of the species, it kind of comes down to those questions, one individual for the group, you know, for the better of the group?
Well, exactly. And Jesus in the novel, in combination with a young man he meets in the novel named Jason, have huge discussions about natural selection and evolution. And that will be eradicated. If you don't have generations and you don't have death, you cannot have natural selection. At least I don't know how you can do it. So it's going to become unnatural selection, like genetic manipulation by humans. There won't be, mind you, humans are, if using natural selection, aren't evolving rapidly right now, right? It takes centuries. And whereas genetic engineering is going to be, it's going to be a tsunami. It's going to hit, and it's going to be fast and furious on so many fronts. But still, going back to natural selection, all the Darwinism stuff and all that, death is the connector between generations, and we won't have natural selection. It'll be some other type of selection.
Yeah, definitely. I think that I'm definitely very excited to read the rest of your book. And I think that these topics are something that is always sort of playing on our minds, whether we realize it or not. So bringing a little bit back now to messages and experiences that you've had that you can share with us, what would you say is a piece of advice that you would give to young people relating to these, just technology advancing in general in this world where it is so hard sometimes to realize what your humanity is, what is the right thing to do?
Yeah. Well, I'm a pretty big fan of technology. I realize there's, you know, ransomware and viruses and things like that out there. But I think I remember back at the early 90s when the internet was just coming out, and I looked at my friend's computer. What the heck's that? And he was loading something. It was like a website, and it took a long time to load. And I said, God, that's useless. It takes too long. I'm too impatient for that, right? But it wasn't useless. I was the internet actually just starting. And so your generation was born into that. I saw it come in, and it's been absolutely incredible. Philosophically, I'm positive on that. I could go back to a philosopher, Teilhard de Chardin, who was a Jesuit Catholic priest, I believe, Teilhard de Chardin. And he wrote in a couple hundred years ago, almost now. And he he was also very positive. He talked about the noosphere, N-O-O-S-P-H-E-R-E, which is sort of the knowledge, noos from knowledge, the Greek word for knowledge, I guess. The sphere of knowledge ever increasing, a shared thing that is you know, embedded in everybody, comes from everyone, and is shared and moves upwards. So he talked about point alpha, the start of the noosphere, maybe the start of the internet, and then point omega, which we're trying to reach as humankind. So it was pretty cool, like that. Those concepts, I think, are just now being seen. And even something like Wikipedia is just incredible. Like, it's a shared thing. It's free service, basically, you know, with contribution or whatever. But one of the most popular websites still, Wikipedia, is a very good example of that. And so I'm very upbeat on it. Now, you can get into the, you know, I don't know if you've read anything about the singularity, this idea of the super intelligent admixture of all of the computer systems Have you read any Ray Kurzweil?
It sounds a little bit familiar. Yeah, that like oneness.
Yeah, it's sort of. So he wrote a book. This was about 15 years ago, called The Singularity Is Near. And if it's a very, I think someone like you, Bright, like you would be interested in it. It's this idea of all the computers and supercomputing facilities merging and reaching a higher consciousness to the point where, unfortunately, humans will be not just redundant, but almost useless and not able to keep up. So not able to conceptualize where it's at, you know, not able to conceptualize that level. So we're going to be sort of swept by the wayside. And that's the point of singularity. And he actually is, I think he's publishing a sequel in a few months. You might want to get your hands on that. It's called The Singularity Is Nearer. Instead of The Singularity Is Near, we just put an ER at the end. And Kurzweil is...
Every couple of years, he can write a new book that's just like closer and closer and closer.
It's that scary concept that this super intelligent supercomputer intelligence sort of stretches off of us. It's not the noosphere of Teilhard de Chardin, but it's beyond that. And it takes, I don't know if it takes control, but it just becomes so beyond us that we lose whatever we have. We're not in charge anymore. So brace yourself. But so like there's always a negative, I think a lot of positive to you if you're speaking just of information technology. I do have in my novel a thing called Neural Integrated Transmitter, which I think your generation will see. I'll probably be dead when this comes in, unless they get aged to solve aging. Maybe I won't be, but this NIT, Neuro Integrated Transmitter, I do believe it's going to happen. So it's the idea of not having a smartphone anymore. Just your brain is plugged into the electrical, to the intelligent device. So you can just do the commands from within your head. You can project, communicate, whatever, like you would with a smartphone, surf the net, whatever. But it's all happening. It's integrated with your neurophysiology. And Elon Musk, I was just listened to a podcast last week, and I guess he already has his Neuralink technology. I didn't know that. So the Neuralink is linking, he used pigs right now, and it actually does invade up to about a centimeter into the pig's cerebrum, into their brain. And it there's about 80 neurons, 80, it's not many yet, but it's a start, that it integrates with. And so far, so good, according to Musk. And he thinks he can use integrated technology to solve things like depression and whatnot. I think genetic engineering is going to be used for depression too. They're already circling the wagons on a lot of the genes involved with chronic disease, chronic pain and depression and schizophrenia and bipolar. So whether it's the Neuralink or the, but these are all technologies, and your generation is going to see them, maybe not embrace all of them, but you're going to benefit from a lot of them. And
absolutely. I think that genetic engineering is also taking off, but another really promising field is neurotechnology. And like, I'm studying neuroscience, like as my major. And one of the technologies that we recently talked about was this cell phone signaling. So you have an artificial brain tissue in Germany, and you have another artificial brain tissue in Sweden, and you can actually activate one and the other at the same time via cell phone signaling, the same way that you call someone across the globe. So I think, yeah, it is interesting to be sort of learning about these things as they're being integrated in our society, much as I imagine it would have been like to hear about the first computers and smartphones. I think, yeah, the best way to sort of accept that into life is through things like science fiction. So another great reason to read the book, prepare for the future that might come.
I'm trying to imagine all this stuff. And, I was even like, there was a scene in New York, and I was trying to figure out, should I put the subway in? Is the subway still going to be there in 200 years? And yes, I included it. I think the subway is going to be hard to get rid of. But they were flying cars.
Interesting question.
Flying cars.
It is interesting to think about those time things.
Yeah. So it's very fun, detailed. But it was a lot of fun doing it. And I think it's a fun read, and it's it's fairly philosophical. It's literary, the novel. It's not sort of bubblegum sci-fi. It's more like, you know, crafted to more like for
people. Definitely some interesting topics that you've like hidden in there, particularly with the main character called Jesus, who's a Buddhist. So I think that's quite clever. Bringing it a little bit back to a professional sense, what advice would you give to somebody who's looking to write a book, become a professor, or get a PhD?
Yeah, so the PhD was probably the easiest thing. Like that, you just have to have decent marks and then have an, and I enjoyed my PhD, it was a lot of fun. I did a PhD in education. Don't ask me why, I just didn't want to do anything more than this. So that was fun though, and I really enjoyed it. It was like 3 years of just exploring things and getting a thesis, and you know, so that was good. The other thing you asked about was
writing a book, and
writing the book was the toughest for me. I had never tried fiction before. I've done a lot of technical things, writing reports and PhD thesis and all that, but that's all you know, that's all nonfiction. So just something like how to construct a sentence or keep a dialogue going, where do you put the paragraph marks and how do you connect conversers, and how do you keep the conversation commensurate for the reader, like so it follows like who's saying what. You don't always want to say he said she said, you know, like so what sort of connectors to use and all that. I had to go back to books and look through and say, see how did Eisenhower do that? He wrote 400 of those, he must know what he's doing, right? 400 novels. So you know, just learning that, and that was fun. So I guess to the readers I would say like that's a creative thing, right? So you just do not pigeonhole yourself. You have the potential to express yourself, whether it's through music, it could be drawing, art, it could be writing, and it could be something we haven't even heard of, some creative thing. Like you're doing a podcast, that's pretty good too. That's a pretty creative way of, you know, sort of getting out beyond yourself a bit. And so to your younger listeners who are, you know, wondering what am I going to do in my life and all that, well, you can do multiple things. You have these embedded talents. You may not even know what your you know what you might try in 15 years. Just obviously do your best with what you're trying right now, and get your education, and stay positive. And you know, it's an insecure. Life is insecure, so you're always going to feel a little bit wobbly. You know how you're on a chair when you're leaning back on the chair and two of the legs are in the air. It's a little wobbly at times, but you'll find your balance. And Helen Keller had a quote that I really love. She said, and she's just an amazing woman in history, who said that security is primarily a superstition. And I just love that. If you want just security, yeah, you can do it with an education and get a job and all that, but you want to be in balance. Sometimes you want to be feel like your chair is wobbling around a bit, and you want to explore, and you want to fail, and you want to be insecure. You know, it's not a bad thing. It can lead to great things, and you can be creative in doing so. So that you know, I don't know if that's a great
piece of advice. Yeah, I think especially in these times when we really don't know what's going to happen, when we're going to be able to travel again, as young people trying to find a job, a house, establish a life is so insecure.
Yes.
So that's definitely a great piece of advice. So I've got two final questions, a little bit fun ones. Okay. What is the craziest thing you have ever done in college, in your professional life, the craziest thing that you think you've ever done?
Okay, I was in Banff with a buddy, Rob, and we literally just had t-shirts and shorts on. It was a nice summer day, and we went climbing up this mountain with no mountain experience. And I didn't realize two things about climbing. One, it always looks like it's leveling off above you. Like if you go a little further, it'll be less steep. That's an illusion. And number two, it's harder to go backwards than to go up. Like, try going backwards down a ladder versus up, you know, it's a lot harder. So those two things almost killed us, because we were literally, we could end up in a situation where we're clinging to the cliff with nowhere to go. And I remember shaking, thinking, I don't want to go any further.
Were you wearing harnesses, or it was just?
Oh, we had nothing. We were just like free climbing.
Oh my goodness.
So luckily, my friend Rob spotted like an evergreen tree hanging out of the rock about 10 feet up to the right of us. He said, if we can just shimmy over to that, we can grab onto it, right? And that's that little tree saved my life and his. Like, there's no way we would have gotten off that cliff. Yeah. That's one crazy thing. What else do you want? You want another crazy thing? Or no?
Yeah, one more question. Oh, I mean, if you want to go on. The last question I had was, if there are any influential, Instagrammers, podcasts, books, something that you've seen recently that you think you found really influential and inspiring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, does it have to be recent?
It doesn't have to be recent, but something that's just been on your mind recently.
Yeah. Well, the whole COVID thing's been intriguing. But I think maybe people have heard enough of that. I don't know. you know, that fight between people who, you know, that individual rights, shouldn't force me to wear a mask or not to take this vaccine, or I don't trust this minister of health or the World Health Organization. That, you know, that fight, the cynicals and individualists versus the people who are more interested in the public good and a little more trusting of the government, which is about public good. And so that's really come out in COVID. And I'm more on the side of the, you know, I'm more pro-vax, pro-mask, whatever. Although I did take a stand on one thing. In our province of Ontario, they, and this happened recently, a couple months ago, they banned golf. And I play golf.
Wow.
And they said, if you can't do this, you can't do anything. So they, even golf and tennis, outdoor sports, and golf, like it's naturally socially distanced. You're out, like,
yeah,
out there. It's just you and four people on like acres of property, right? So they banned golf. So I did start tweeting the Minister of Health and the Premier and the Solicitor General saying, how can you ban golf? And I even had couple of funny tweets where I had, like, there was this one where I had this hovercraft coming in from off this lake and zooming across the lake and onto this golf course with two guys with their bags of golf clubs on the back saying, and I said, this is the only way you can get onto a golf course in Ontario. You know, it is ridiculous, but they changed their mind eventually. But, you know, sometimes the governments do go overboard, and that people need to reflect on that and make sure that people are, you know, like, even with emergency measures, you have to make sure they're not just dictatorially applied. They have to be rationally applied. And there is no evidence that golf and even some other things caused significant COVID or anything, right? So you don't want to punish people just, but I'm still a big fan of the public good. And I think our politicians here have done a pretty good job. So, is that
keeping a level head? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely important. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today on I2. I think that our listeners would learn something for sure. I've definitely learned a lot speaking to you, and I'm very excited to go and read the rest of your book.
Thank you. I'll send you the link if you don't already have it. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be on the I2 show. Julia, you're doing a great job, and I'm humbled and honored to be part of your show.